We have this idea, I think, especially for the Arctic, because it's so affected by climate change, that somehow everybody's life is about climate change, that if you ask them what's happening, what do you want to talk about, that they're going to talk to you about climate change. But they don't end up being stories about climate change, but to me they're stories about what's at stake when it comes to climate change. Because it's all of the things that people love and all of the expertise that they have and all of the family stories that they hold and the cultural stories that they have. I mean, that's the diversity that's at stake when the landscape is changing.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast, where I interview the world's best storytellers about how they craft the stories they tell. Before we jump into this episode, a quick shout out to our sponsor this week, my parents, because I am currently living at home with them and we're having some good times. So Mama and Papa, I know you're listening. Shout out to you. I love you both. My guest on the show this week is Jennifer Kingsley. Jennifer is a National Geographic Explorer and a fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. She is a winner of the National Outdoor Book Award for Paddle North, which we talk about in this episode. And her writing has appeared in various outlets, including National Geographic, the BBC, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Her radio documentaries have been broadcast internationally and recognized by the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. Jennifer holds degrees in both biology and fine art, and she is based in Ottawa, Canada. In this conversation, Jennifer and I talk about how she developed a love for both writing and exploration. We talk about her fascinating three-year project called Meet the North, in which she attempted to make authentic, personal connections with those living in the Arctic. And then we also talk about how we can all use storytelling to break down stereotypes and prejudices. So with that, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jennifer Kingsley. All right, let's both hit record.
Okay.
And let's jump into
there
it.
There we go. Great.
All right, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It's great to have you. We've been communicating over email for a couple months now, so I'm glad we could make it happen.
Yeah, me too.
I'd love to jump right into the conversation. Exploration is a huge theme in your work, and seems to have always been, from what I could tell, you know, core to who you are. And I'm curious, where did this love for adventure and exploration, like, where did that come from? Or where do we chart it back to?
Well, first of all, I think I've always been comfortable on the move. That's kind of how I grew up. Like a lot of people, my parents separated when I was quite young. So I lived at my mom's house, but then visited my dad's house. And I also spent a lot of time at my grandma's house. So in some ways, I've always been comfortable with a suitcase. Hmm. I went away from home for my first major trip when I was 11 years old. I went to Thailand for 5 weeks without my parents on an international. Yeah, when I was 11.
Wow. And that was for, how did that come about?
It was for an international children's peace camp.
Okay.
And it was run by an organization called Children's International Summer Villages. Mm-hmm. And they ran these camps, and I think still do, around the world for delegations of four 11-year-olds, two boys and two girls from a variety of countries.
Wow.
And I had a kind of last-minute opportunity to go. And it was over Christmas. And before that, the only time I'd ever been away from home was for a weekend at Girl Guide Camp. And so, yeah, that was, you know, 5 weeks with three kids and a sort of 20-something-year-old leader that I hadn't really met before. Mm-hmm. And that was something I think about actually more and more now that I get more and more into storytelling, because that was formative. And it seems obvious now, but at the time, you know, I didn't think about that really for a long time. But yeah, we were kids from, I believe, 8 different nations. Mm-hmm. And mostly we didn't have a language in common. Mm-hmm. And yet when I think back to the memories of that time, I don't even remember that. I don't remember not being able to communicate with my friends from all these different places.
And why do you think, or as you reflect on it now, what do you think was formative about it?
Well, I mean, going to Bangkok at that time by myself and up into northern Thailand, I mean, that was a pretty big leap. It was certainly everything about that was new for me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was fun. It was fine. We did fine.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of, yeah, one maybe gave me an understanding of the possibilities of travel and just what you can do on your own. Mm-hmm. It was also my first experience as a minority. Like, it was my first experience outside of the kind of middle class white Canada that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. But also every moment of that was cross-cultural. I mean, all of my friends, some of whom I corresponded with for years afterwards, they were all from different countries, and many of them didn't speak any English. Mm-hmm. And so I think that really grounded me in this, in the possibility of these cross-cultural relationships with people.
And whether it was when you were at that age, when you were traveling, or afterwards, at what point did you start embracing storytelling as a way to make meaning out of your travel and exploration?
I think that probably started also when I was really young with diaries. Hmm. My grandmother, who immigrated to Canada as a teenager and had only a sort of middle school education, she was the one who gave me my first diary. And she was the one who said, you know, you keep notes, write down what's happening for you. And I was very close with my grandma, and so I did. And it was at first only when I traveled. So when I was in Thailand, when I was a kid, when I lived with a family in India for a few months when I was 20. But all of the trips, even my wilderness trips, I like to write stories. And then every time, especially if I was having a really difficult time when I was away, I would always reach for my journal. And I would always just start writing, particularly when I'm, and that's still the case, particularly when I'm in a place where I have no one to talk to. Mm. And so, I don't know, to me, books were a huge part of my growing up. I spent a lot of time on my own as a kid, and so I spent a lot of time reading. And I think those two things just became intertwined. I mean, I've had so many opportunities to learn about the world from being out in the world. Mm. And then I've also had so many opportunities to learn about the world from reading.
So I think some people, when they have a diary or they get like one of those nice little notebooks, they spend a couple days or the first couple days after they get the notebook writing some notes or putting some thoughts down, but then it kind of like fades away. What about the habit seemed to connect with you? Why did you really enjoy that?
Yeah, well, you know, now that I'm a writer, I mean, now that that's my profession, mm-hmm. it's also a discipline. I mean, I write now because it's my work and it is a discipline. It's a habit and I don't always want to do it. In fact, I often don't want to do it. journaling for me was either during difficult emotional times or yeah. during my travel, like for my travels. But now as a writer, I think it's probably the most important part of my craft, just that discipline, like, every day you write notes, and it doesn't really matter what they are. It just matters that you write them down. And I think that's also helped me keep it up. You know, on days that you're just overwhelmed or exhausted or don't even know what's happening or just don't want to. But these, even if it's scraps of sentences or a few bullet points, I mean, those are gold later, because those, you're going to forget all that stuff, even though you don't think you could ever forget it, right? I mean, we've all had that experience. You will forget it. So you just have to write it down.
And did you know that you wanted to become a writer when you grew up?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I studied biology. My first degree is in science. Mm-hmm. I studied natural history. And I did a little bit of field science, but pretty quickly was in the communication side. So working at our national parks here in Canada, working as a guide, working on sailboats, working on ships, which I still do. I work a lot with Lindblad Expeditions. They sponsor my work as a journalist now as well.
Very cool.
And yeah, I just couldn't kind of get away from the storytelling. And yeah, the writing life can be pretty isolated. I mean, writing can be pretty slow.
Yeah.
But I think you also, as a storyteller, you just sort of, you find out what your medium is and you don't always have a choice.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into your book, Paddle North. Can you describe what this project was and how this idea came to be?
Yes. Paddle North is my first book. It's still my only book. And it's the story of a 54-day canoe expedition that I took across the Canadian Arctic. So it was about 1,100 kilometers down one of the rivers I think of as the longest river in Canada that nobody's ever heard of. It's called the Back River.
Okay.
And it was me and five friends. So three canoes, like I said, 54 days, and this just absolutely incredible river. And it was not the first trip of that length that I had completed, but it was in a class by itself in the sense that it was a journey that just challenged me beyond what I expected, beyond what I wanted. And it was a story that after I got home, it just wouldn't leave me alone. You know, we had so many unusual experiences and encounters during those 54 days.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I came home and I wanted to write about it. And so that was kind of the, I would say that was when I knew that I was going to take a run at this whole storytelling thing. I mean, I went back to school, I did a master's in writing,
yeah,
knowing that I would need some structure to actually complete the book. But yeah, it was, and you'd asked about my journals. I would also say that when I left for that trip, I had no intention of writing a book about it. And so the diary that I kept is in some ways my last diary. Like it's the last time that I was writing only for myself.
Oh, interesting.
You know, now I write for myself, but I'm a writer. So I know that I will probably come back to those pages, that I'll come back to the details, that I have certain things I want to record about scraps of dialogue or the weather or, you know, but that diary that I wrote on the Back River, it was just truly, it was for me. And probably the last time I'll ever be able to do that.
So where were you in life, like either personally or career-wise, when you set out for such an expedition like that? Were you just hoping to kind of just get away with some friends, or was it more of kind of like a vision quest? Like, what were you hoping to attain by going on this, you know, 54-day canoe trip in the Arctic?
I just wanted to be in the wilderness. And in that way, the Back River was a huge turning point for me, because that was at the time when I still related to the North as a wilderness. You know, the purpose of that trip was to paddle this incredible river, but more so to get away from people. You know, to spend those weeks without seeing any other humans. And in the end, we did see a couple of people along the way, but overall, it was to get away from people and to be in that version of the North that I thought of as a wilderness. And I still believe that the North is a wilderness in some ways, but I also recognize now that that is a very common construction of the North, particularly by people from the South like me. And so it was during the process of writing Paddle North and through through the process of writing Paddle North, and after the book came out, I realized, like, I don't have a single friend who lives in the North. The Arctic is eight nations. It's home to over 4 million people. I don't know any of them.
Right.
And yet now I'm guiding in the North. I've written this whole book about the North that really, Although there is a lot of human history in the book, I would say it does uphold this idea of the wilderness as being a pretty empty place. Mm-hmm. Of the North, sorry, as being a pretty empty place.
Was that part of your allure to go there? Was this kind of romanticized vision of the North as empty and wild and untouched?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was a biologist. I wanted to see wolves and grizzly bears and the caribou migration and all of the extraordinary things that are up there that are on this beautiful Arctic tundra ecosystem. And yet it was more after that journey. And like I said, I had done other similar journeys before that this idea of like, what is the North became, well, who is the North? And why don't I know anything about the culture of the North other than, probably these outdated ideas about, you know, from explorers' tales.
Yeah.
And I guess that probably brings us also to exploration. And you know, how do you go forward as an explorer now? Mm-hmm. And what does that word mean? For me, I'm quite comfortable with exploring as a verb.
Okay.
And I'm less comfortable with it as a noun. So, I mean, I think this title, The Explorer, I mean, there is so much in that word. And so much of our colonial history, to me, is attached to that word. Mm-hmm. But there's also, of course, a lot of positive action and interesting projects that are attached to that word these days. Mm. So, what does it mean to go explore? And so for me now, it's about meeting people.
Yeah.
And about continuing to learn about landscape, but from the people who know it the best, and that is never me.
Hmm. And so did this project, which we're kind of bridging towards, which is your project Meet the North, was that a like direct response to having written this book Paddle North, which was very much about the wilderness and introspective, and you realizing, wait, hold on, I don't even know anyone personally here. Was Meet the North a response to that?
Yeah, yes. It was kind of a confluence of things. Mm-hmm. One of those, another moment you kind of look back on in life and realize, wow, I was really in the right place, the right time.
Yeah.
Paddle North came out. I had an opportunity to reconnect with Lindblad Expeditions to work on one of their ships in the Arctic. And it was after that that the CEO there invited me to come down to New York, and he asked me a question, and I will never forget this. He said, if you had a reasonable magic wand and you were going to stick around my company for a couple of years, what would you create?
Wow.
And I thought, oh boy, don't get this wrong.
Right.
But I knew at that point, you know, how much work it was to bring a book into the world. Mm-hmm. I knew that I wanted to continue as a journalist, as a storyteller. And I knew that if I was going to keep traveling, I wanted to find a way to learn from people.
Yeah.
And to learn along the way. So that's where Meet the North was born. And broadly, it was a 3-year project to travel to different Arctic communities. But the method of Meet the North, it was an experiment and it wasn't perfect, but it was really important to me. And that was to travel from recommendation to recommendation. So I call it Meet the North, Life in the Arctic, One Introduction at a Time. And we go to a community, provided that we have one person who knows that we're coming and wants us to be there.
Okay.
And that we have a place to stay.
So are those just of friends who you get that original connection to in a city or place?
Yeah, usually in a community. I mean, it depends. One of the amazing things about Meet the North is that it has truly pole vaulted me completely outside of my own social network, which is very difficult to do, actually. You know, how would you do that? How would you go about, you know, meeting people to whom you had zero connection, you know, that wasn't a friend of a friend?
Right.
So, I mean, one of the connections we made, the reason that we went and spent 6 weeks on the northern tip of Baffin Island in the community of Pond Inlet was from a woman I met on an airplane. And yes, sometimes it was starting with a recommendation from somebody that I knew. When we went to Russia, though, I mean, I was literally like cold calling people all over Russia. I mean, I didn't know anybody there.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do start. It's true. You do start with a few connections. But the idea then was to ask whoever we spent time with who they thought we should meet next. And to plan our itinerary as much as possible solely based on those recommendations.
Had you ever done anything like that before in terms of finding individuals to speak to for stories?
No.
And what did that, what kind of world did that open up for you as a storyteller?
Well, I think after a few years of this, I'm now awkward proof. Like, I've been in so many unusual and awkward situations, you know, asking, basically building a totally spontaneous itinerary. But as a storyteller, it showed me that just how crammed full of stories the world is. And that we have no idea what they are or where they are. And sometimes they're literally just within arm's reach.
Yeah.
You know, you never know. And like I say, the method, it's not perfect, but it was, for me, it was an exercise in disrupting how journalism gets done, at least for me. So what happens when you travel as a journalist without a story idea? You let that idea come to you. You request recommendations. You work with people who want to work with you. And I was always looking for the stories that people wanted to tell. And so, of course, some kinds of stories will never come to you that way, right? I mean, there's plenty of stories that people don't want told. And I mean, certainly you could never have, you know, a political journalist or a crime journalist working only on stories that other people wanted to tell.
Yeah.
But I think when you're traveling in communities as a visitor, and particularly with people whose stories have very little or no room in the media, then I find this totally fascinating. To me, it's a fascinating process. Like, well, what is it that you want to talk about? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah. So I'm curious what specifically that looks like. Maybe you can kind of paint the picture for us in terms of you getting to a community, whether that's a small or big community. You get there, you know, you maybe met one person, but once you're starting to like approach strangers, what does that like specifically look like? You just going up and saying, hey, so I'm doing this thing and I just want you to hear what's on your mind.
I mean, I think I've gotten better at it. At the beginning, it was often really awkward. Like, oh, hi, I'm Jenny. I've got a project. You know, I need a place to stay. Can I have your phone number? You know, sort of trying to get it all out. Like, everything gets all jumbled. But it's essentially I start with an explanation of the project. And, you know, basic rules on free prior informed consent. So people understand what they would be agreeing to and what might happen to the stories and where they might be published. Yeah, and so I'll ask, hey, you know, could you meet up later? You know, just sort of set it up in a way that works for them. I'm most interested in doing things with people rather than talking with them.
Okay.
Or ideally a combination of both.
And why is that?
Well, I mean, partly because I've been saying we. I've had the great privilege of working side by side with a photographer throughout this whole process. And Eric Guth has been the photographer for Meet the North and now for our work in French Polynesia. So I mean, we also just have an opportunity to tell stories visually, which means you want to be out there. You want to be doing stuff.
Right.
And I want to see, you know, I just want to be with people while they're doing whatever it is that they do. And then maybe talking about it afterwards. So, yeah, it's really like I don't know. I have no set questions.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely sort of subscribe to this, you know, idea of the ideal interview that I once heard, which is, oh, well, what happened? Well, and then what happened? And then what happened? You know, like, so I guess I can't really describe it, but I think, I mean, also there's plenty of people who don't want to talk to me. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to give the idea that it's just this like ideal, idyllic thing. I mean, yeah, there's lots of people who aren't interested in participating, of course, right? But yeah. For the people who are, we found a lot of people who really are, who really have time for us and who really are willing to try and make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this just, I mean, some of the places that we've been, people have been through a great deal. People have been through many painful experiences, and often those painful experiences are connected to outsiders, right? To some element of colonialism, to some element of the media, perhaps. And yet there's still people out there who are willing to try again.
Yeah.
And without them, we wouldn't be able to learn anything about these places.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for that. And I don't think I'll ever really understand why people make that choice. But
yeah.
But when they do, we just go from there. So then, and then the stories do often knit together into themes. So the stories that I end up publishing and writing, radio documentaries that I make, are not typically in the interview structure. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, we did this and then we did this and then we did this. But, you know, in Iceland, we ended up with like, oh, we're finding this theme of food security.
Hmm.
What is it like to be farming at the top of the world in a place that's experiencing one of the biggest global tourism booms?
Wow.
You know, in Svalbard, people are talking about energy, and how are they talking about their energy security as a community?
Hmm.
In Russia, it was layers of history and how people's lives, even nomadic people on the tundra, are this fascinating mix of traditional technology, Soviet technology, modern technology. So the themes come, but
yeah. Did the people,
we try to let the stories come to us? Yeah.
The people you were talking to on this trip, did you get the sense that they feel as though traditional media paints just broad stripes and kind of creates stereotypes of life there? And I wonder if they do, if they kind of did have that perspective, how do you feel like that influenced their openness to talk to you or the stories in which they shared with you?
Yeah, I think the answer is I've encountered all different kinds of attitudes and experience. So, I mean, in the Arctic, that's 8 different countries and people with widely different access to media, different levels of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, yeah, I mean, people have asked me, like, why does everybody think we live in igloos, or some of those real, real time-tested stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, I have met people also in different countries who are reluctant, with good reason, to share their experience with marine mammal hunting. Of course, there's a lot of seal, whale, walrus hunting in the Arctic in different countries. I met many people who've had, for them, like really bad experiences when they've chosen to share that with outsiders, and they feel that that's really misunderstood.
Hmm.
But it depends. I mean, I also, yeah, I remember meeting some reindeer herders in Russia who were very interested in the logistics of my project. Like, well, how is it funded? You know, how did you get here? Who's paying for this? Where is this all going? You know, like
yeah.
Really good questions about just, well, okay, how do you actually do what you do? Like, you say this is your living. Well, how does that work?
Yeah.
But I, you know, some of the questions I've been asked, I think, have really stood out in my mind. You know, in the northern part of Baffin Island in a community called Pond Inlet. Someone asked me, why does everybody know that we're number one in suicide and nobody knows that we're number one in celebration?
Hmm.
So no, look, yeah, understanding that so much of the bad news gets south, and that's kind of it, especially in Canada. And as a Canadian, you know, working up there was closer to home than anywhere else, not just geographically, but I mean, that's more directly a part of my history mm-hmm. and my culture.
So I heard from this trip, I heard your radio documentary, Humans of the Arctic, on CBC.
Right.
And yeah. I'm wondering if, unlike, you know, you mentioned how your book Paddle North is you went on this adventure, you weren't planning to write a book. And when you started Meet the North, did you have a plan to create an audio documentary? And if so, like, why audio? What did that allow you to do right. that maybe writing didn't? And yeah, how did that project kind of shape out?
Well, I did always plan to make recordings and to gather tape for radio stories. So the one you mentioned, they called it Humans of the Arctic, and then we changed the name to be just Meet the North. Mm-hmm. And then I also made a documentary about a family called Meet the Elverums, which is, again, a Canadian family. And we've been working on little mini audio documentaries to accompany some of the photographs that Eric's been taking. Audio taught me about the importance of character. You know, you can write about the landscape, you can film a landscape, you can write about concepts, but unless you're an experimental sound artist, you know, if you're going to make a radio story, you need a person, you need a character to take you through that story. And so it's really well suited to a cultural project. And I think audio strikes a good balance with what I'm trying to do, because you hear people's voice, you hear people's voices, which immediately to me paints such a picture, right? As soon as you hear
yeah.
the sound of anyone's voice. But also within the audio format, there's an understanding that there's an editor and that there's a storyteller.
Hmm.
And to me, that's the personal responsibility piece that's also really important.
Can you say
more
about that?
I don't believe in this idea of the storyteller as a kind of megaphone. Right? Hmm. We are not just amplifying a signal that's already there. Anybody who's gone to report on a story will tell you that as soon as you show up, things change.
Right.
It changes with you being there.
Absolutely.
It changes with you asking questions. It changes with you recording things. So this idea that we're giving voice or bringing a megaphone to me is false. And when you make a radio documentary, you have the authentic recording from that moment, but you're also being transparent about the editing process, that as a storyteller, you are playing an active role in the end product. You are curating and editing and building that end product. And so I think you are at the same time acknowledging that your role is key to whatever your audience hears in the end.
Hmm.
And so for me, the message is kind of, yeah, the medium is the message in that way.
Oh, that's so, that's so interesting. And it's something I've been thinking about recently, because my National Geographic Explorer project was this documentary on maternal health in Zambia. I've talked about a number of times on the show, and you know, I'm new to this documentary filmmaking thing, especially ones that are, the scope of the project is pretty big. And for some reason, probably because of my journalism background, where you kind of strip yourself out of the story for like a hard news story, I have always had this kind of sense when I make a documentary film, like I can't be in it. And now that I'm in like the post-production of that, I'm realizing that in some ways there is some dishonesty, or I'm questioning where that came from, like where that idea that I can't be a part of it came from. Because a lot of the documentaries that I've loved this year, they are more transparent about the storyteller. And you look at different radio programs, whether it's like Radio Lab, I think was very influential in that. And now like New York Times, The Daily, like they're always in radio seems to be just a little bit more transparency about how this is being created. So I haven't thought about it the way you put it. So I really like that.
Yeah, it's a conundrum, isn't it? Like that I think we all face. And to me, I mean, I've never been a hard news journalist. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever will be. But it's also, you know, we are in our stories, which doesn't mean they're first person stories. Right? So to like that's something I think about now is in order to acknowledge that you're a part of the story that you're telling, sure, making it a first person story, like here I am and this is how I feel and la la la. I mean, that's one way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the only way to do that. And I think I am tiring of that a little bit, although I certainly do plenty of first person storytelling myself. But I think that's also, to me, that's sort of an innovation edge at the moment is like, how can we innovate that form as storytellers to acknowledge our role as story makers without taking over, without just participating? I mean, I have to say, I feel like 3/4 of the world now everybody has their camera pointing in the wrong direction. I don't understand. Like, why are you pointing your camera at yourself? Like, show me where you are. Just turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in between there, for me, is kind of the sweet spot. Yeah. And, you know, playing with that marriage of form and content, that's for me probably the most interesting part of storytelling is what's the best medium for this? What's the best way to intertwine form and content? And digital storytelling, of course, gives us all kinds of opportunities to do that. You know, animation and cartography and like, you know, sound and still photography. Because I also think video shows us kind of what's out there. And I think audio, even when the story is about someone else, it shows us like what's in here. To me, that audio always is more reflective. It kind of draws you in to yourself and it's more private somehow. And I find that very appropriate for stories that I hope help us see our own stereotypes and our own prejudices. And certainly that's a daily process for me when I'm in the field meeting people, is like seek and destroy, like what stereotypes am I bringing? What unconscious bias am I bringing? Of course I have that. Everybody has that. So the objective is not to hide that. It's to actually find it and bring it forward. And then I think once those things can see the light, that's when they can break down.
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated by this approach of coming up to people, listening to what they want to share. In that audio documentary, I think there's a quote I have written down here that you said that says, "There's a lot of power in the stories people want to tell." So you go to people, you listen to those stories they want to tell, and then you ask them for a recommendation of who to talk to next. So I'm like ready to try. I want to try this. And one of my questions is, do you ever get caught up in kind of bubbles or kind of cycles of these people who know each other? When
all
you
the
do
time.
This? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All the time.
So how do you break out of those cycles?
Well, I don't.
Okay.
I guess I think, you know, if you want me to meet your brother and you want me to meet your cousin and you want me to meet the farmer down the road and you, then so be it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that trail of recommendations shows me something as well, right? It often shows me what people value, what they find interesting, who they think is interesting, and how connected they are and how. And again, I'm not doing this as a researcher. I'm not making sociological conclusions from this.
Right.
But I thought about that a lot at the beginning, is like, oh, and now I'm only talking to women, or I'm only, very often, you know, it does, depending on where you are, sometimes, you know, you end up talking to a lot of men. Mm-hmm. But I've just decided that it's okay.
Yeah.
And but the thing I found the hardest is often I'll say, well, usually how I phrase it is, you know, we're here to learn more about your community, to learn more about your community. Who would you recommend that we speak to next?
Gotcha. So give a little bit of guidance in that.
Very often, well, sometimes, or just like, yeah, thank you so much. We'd like to speak to someone else.
Yeah.
Who do you think we should speak to next? And very often people will say, well, what are you looking for?
Hmm.
Like, who do you want to meet? Tell me more.
Right.
And that's, I've often wondered if I should provide more structure, but because also you're sort of putting people on the spot, right?
Yeah.
But trying to keep it that open, I don't know. In the end, I think that works, at least for now.
What types of stories would people share with you that resonated with you the most? Maybe you could give a specific example.
Sure.
And resonated with you in a way where you felt like, this is what I came here for. This is what I want this project to be about. This is breaking down stereotypes and really giving a honest depiction of who the people are who live in this place.
Well, I think I will give you a specific example. I think what I love about doing this is the opportunity to share the story of an individual. Because I think it's more often from small communities or communities that we think of as far away that people are used as stand-ins for their whole community. Hmm. Like if you read a profile about somebody in New York City, that right. person is not usually, depending on who they are in the community, asked to kind of be a representative of a group of people.
Hmm.
Like that person may get to just be standing there to represent themselves. And that's my goal with these stories. Is this is the story about Elias, or this is the story about Serena, this is the story about Shelley. That's it.
Yeah.
And to me, there's something very important about that. Mm. So when I was in Eastern Russia, we'd ask this, oh, who do you think we should meet next? And who do you think we should meet next? And we found ourselves in this small but powerful group of women. Women in their 60s and 70s who were indigenous women who had been journalists during the Cold War. And they all recommended each other. Like they were storytellers, teachers. Oh, have you spoken to Larissa? Have you spoken to Svetlana, Elizaveta? Have you spoken to Tatiana? And that's like you said, well, what happens? It seemed like a dead end. To me, it more just shows that like that I have found this cluster of significance, like that these women are important to others, and because everybody wants me to talk to them.
Yeah.
And so to hear, like, for example, Svetlana was a radio journalist during the Cold War, and she'd grown up with her grandmother saying, of course, so the Cold War cut communication between the far eastern part of Russia and Alaska, the western reaches of Alaska. So it cut particularly the Yupik community in half. I mean, just right down the middle. People, of course, are related to each other. They speak the same language on both sides of the Bering Strait, and they were not able to travel as they had been doing forever. They are not able to see each other.
Mm.
And Svetlana grew up with her grandmother saying, like, when will I ever be able to see my family again? Will I ever see them before I die? And Svetlana's job was to tell stories, to talk about what was happening in the region with Chukchi people, with Yupik people, and she would broadcast these stories along with government messages over the radio. And so for decades, I mean, she was doing this for many years, but knowing that this was sort of only now going to her Russian community, to the Russian side. And it wasn't until she finally flew over to Alaska for a conference in like maybe somewhere between 1989 and 1991. She didn't remember the exact date. And somebody was stood at this conference with a tape and said, is there a woman named Svetlana here?
Hmm.
and she didn't know why, and she didn't want to answer, and she didn't know if there was tension because of these messages, the government messages that she had been saying. And then over the next few days, as the whole story came out, she realized, like, these people in Alaska had been listening to her the whole time.
Wow.
And they knew when she was going to come on the radio, and they waited for her, and they waited to hear her voice. And she was talking to them. She was telling them their news, you know, all this time. And now she's a little old lady, like, living in an apartment building in a Nadir community, the largest community in Chukotka, you know, in this sort of concrete apartment block. And it was her granddaughter who recommended that we meet her. And wow. She's just this totally amazing woman who'd been telling the stories of her people and her community, you know, as a journalist, working in the 70s, working in the 80s, traveling all over the countryside, and, you know, sitting there serving us boiled eggs and caviar and tea on a Wednesday afternoon.
That's amazing.
I'm not sure if it was Wednesday, but, you know, just Sunday.
Sounded good. I'm wondering how much you're thinking about climate change.
That's a great question.
There.
I've actually even had someone ask me if I'm avoiding climate change in my work.
Why do you think get that question?
Because wouldn't you know, when you go and ask have these open-ended interviews and you want to hear the stories that people want to tell, you find out whatever, you know, people are not obsessing about climate change every day. We have this idea, I think, especially for the Arctic, because it's so affected by climate change, that somehow everybody's life is about climate change. That if you ask them what's happening, what do you want to talk about, that they're going to talk to you about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, to me that almost shows they don't end up being stories about climate change, but to me they're stories about what's at stake when it comes to climate change. Because it's all of the things that people love and all of the expertise that they have and all of the family stories that they hold and the cultural stories that they have. I mean, that's the diversity that's at stake when the landscape is changing.
Yeah.
But I think that's also, to me, an important lesson. Like, just because climate change in the Arctic is top of mind for us who are not from the Arctic doesn't mean it's going to be top of mind right now for the people who are living there.
Right.
Just like it wouldn't be for us, you know. Like, if you went, I don't know, like, there's the United, the American government is making headlines all over the world right now. Mm-hmm. If you go to the U.S. and want to find out what people are really doing and what they love, what they're passionate about, I mean, not everyone's going to talk to you about what's happening in the government. They're going to talk to you about whatever's going on for them, right?
Right.
You know, if you went to Venezuela right now and started talking, doing personal stories and personal story-based journalism, yeah, some of it's going to be about the massive upheaval with their government, but not everyone. There's more to people's lives than those headlines.
Yeah.
But I think what's really important when you ask about climate change is that I also would never want to trivialize the big issues. We say, oh yeah, well, this is just so-and-so's life.
Right.
So yeah, I guess that's kind of a balance.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
As well.
Yeah, because you are, I mean, as a region that will be, well, everyone's going to be impacted, but I love that what you're saying about kind of showing what's at risk. And I think about a lot of the stories that are told about climate change, it can be easy to lose the humanity in that. And that's what I think people really connect with and empathize with. So even if it's not directly about climate change, even showing the people who will be affected is a powerful message.
Well, and I think it's an interesting, climate change is an interesting problem, right? Because from a storytelling perspective, because it's very important, Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make it interesting.
Right.
And I don't mean across the board.
Yeah.
But like, how many headlines have I seen about the Greenland ice sheet? It's melting 4 times faster. It's melting 2 times faster. This is this is very important. Mm-hmm. But it's not always very interesting.
Right.
How do we tell those stories? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of it's news. It's just like, here is an important fact about Greenland that we've learned, that the scientists have just learned, and we're publishing it because it needs to be out there. And I totally get that. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, I think those of us who do not live up north, or maybe climate change generally, although I think we're coming out of this, is we sort of have this luxury of still projecting it into the future.
Yeah.
You know, many of the places that I've been in the Arctic, the sea ice hasn't been there for a long time. This is not only in the present, it's actually in the past.
Wow.
Like, the changes are continuing.
Right.
But some of the things that we still read about, like, oh, the sea ice, the quality of the sea ice is changing. People, there's not even sea ice there at all anymore. Like, nobody crosses the Bering Strait on the sea ice anymore. There's no sea ice there. Hmm. I mean, not none, but not enough for people to, I mean, that some of these ideas that we have that we still think of as sort of emerging are totally past based when you get there and really meet people. Mm-hmm. So that's also then another really interesting thing to learn about, I think, is, well, then people have adapted. Not to say that the change isn't still coming and that there aren't really big impacts, but I've also met people who have made significant changes in their lifetime in order to do what they can to adapt to the change. Hmm. And maybe that's something I don't hear that much about.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's January and it's Tuesday morning and you live in Greenland and there's no sea ice, but you still need to hunt. So what are you going to do?
Right.
And people aren't talking about it or thinking about it. They're actually doing what needs to be done.
So you mentioned to me before we started the podcast that you're now in writing mode.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what it is that you're kind of still formulating. Are you working on a book? What do you want to say from, because it's born out of Meet the North, right?
Yeah. Yep. The writing that I'm doing now is based on the work that I've been doing in the North.
Okay.
And we've published, you know, we've made a lot of stories. We've published stuff. We've made documentaries and so on along the way. And I think the purpose of the deeper journey, or how it's changed me, and also just many of the things that we've done and experienced have not been told. And so I think also, I don't know how you deal with this, but many of, you just have so many inputs, so many things coming at you. And for me, those sort of all go in a bank. Mm-hmm. And you have to clear out that bank to like tell all of it, or at least big chunks of it, in order to make room for the next step. And we've been telling like select pieces, but there's just so much that I haven't said about what we've been doing and why we've been doing it. And so I've got some time now to commit that to paper, and then it will take a shape as it needs to, I think.
And how has Meeting the North changed you?
It's made me a way better listener. Hmm. If you ask my family, they would probably still say I have a long way to go. But I'm convinced that listening is the most important skill a storyteller can have. Hmm. It has given me I believe that there's still room and a place for outsiders and visitors to go to communities. Mm-hmm. And that was something I was not sure of when I started this, like, because also there hasn't been room in the media for people to tell their own stories. So I was like, well, is this idea of the explorer, of the visitor, of the outsider, is it just time for that to end? And to me, the answer is that no, there is still a time and a place for outsiders and visitors, but it's the balance and the methods where we have a responsibility to innovate.
So where do you feel like that it is time to end that? In what ways? Or using what methods?
Yeah, I still think, I mean, we... It's a great question. Again, I think the answer is probably a balance. Like, I would have ideas, but I also, you know, each community, each person will have their own view on, like, where there's time and space for outsiders and where there isn't. I guess I think because of how the media landscape has changed, how funding has changed, we've been forced, if we want to be storytellers, too often into this kind of fill-in-the-blanks journalism. Like, I'm going to go here to report on this. I'm going to talk to these people. I'm going to find out what they have to say. I'm going to come back and I'm going to do this.
Right.
And there can be some great reporting that comes from that. Like, of course, you're going to have blinders. I mean, you've already had to choose what you're going to say about a place that you've never been.
Right.
Like, how does that even work?
Right. Especially when you're writing, like, a grant application.
Of course, yeah. Right? In order to get the money, in order to go there at all.
Yeah.
And so, like, why are we going there? Yeah, and so yeah, I definitely don't know the answer to that one. That's a big question probably for us all to take up as a community. And I think that those discussions will be really interesting. They're happening now within National Geographic, which I know we're both a part of, which I think is really good.
Yeah.
This, like, who's telling whose story and why. And that for me is also part of the reconciliation process, particularly with Indigenous people, that we are all a part of.
And on the topic of personal change for you, another line that I wrote down from your audio documentary that I felt was really powerful is you posed this question. What are all the things that are right there that you never thought about, saw, or listened to? That is when a place really comes alive. Like, when I heard that, I was like, bold, boom, write it down. Like, I just, like, I just love it. And, you know, it struck me because, so this year I've been really interested in kind of doing Humans of New York type portrait photography and talking to strangers and hearing their story. I've been really into that. And I feel like I do it more when I'm traveling. You know, I'm just in this like state of mind where like I want to go up and like hear about you and your dog or whatever it is. And then back in my home communities, like back home, I'm reluctant to do it. I'm like, I'm reluctant to seek out the stories that are really all around me. And I'm wondering if you could reflect a little bit on that quote and how it relates to your personal journey and whether that is changing the way that you show up in everyday life, not just when you're in the field.
Yes. Yeah, so two things about that quote and what you said. One, this idea, why don't we do that when we're at home? That is a very good question.
Yeah.
Like, why don't I do that when I'm at home? I don't know. I don't know. And in fact, I am quite disconnected from the place that I live. Because I travel so much, I'm away so much. I mean, I have my partner, Tobias, at home, who is like the anchor. You know, he's just, like a very important person in my life for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that kind of tethering to home.
Yeah, shout out Tobias.
but, and I'm fortunate to have like a community of friends and family, but like beyond that sort of maybe 15 people that I see regularly, I'm not connected to where I live.
Yeah.
You know, nobody expects me anywhere on a Tuesday. There's nowhere that anyone expects me to show up. You know, I read more about faraway places than I read about my own place. So why is that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But for me, I think that the circle is sort of closing in. Like the things that I've learned very far away from home are starting to influence me at home more and more. Like my listening, I think,
yeah,
is getting better. But yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it might be somewhere in this roots of this idea of the explorer mindset, that there's a sort of value and status in going away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think I need to take more of a look at, because of course that is absolutely a mark of privilege and status. Just travel here, travel there, do this, get this grant, go here, go there. Like, well, is there true value in that?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, what is it? And let's make sure that we, you know, isolate the real value beyond the sort of like, list of places that we've been.
Yeah.
But I think when you say like, you know, all these things that we've never looked at or never seen, I need a guide to tell me what to look at. And when people agree to help me with this work and to talk to me and for me to listen, like that is, like I said earlier, learning to look at the landscape when you're guided by the people who know it best, which is not the same as seeing it from their perspective. I will never see it from their perspective.
Right.
I don't believe that that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I will never understand it. But you don't need to understand something in order to respect it.
Mm.
You don't need to understand someone's boundary in order to respect that boundary.
Right.
And I think sometimes we get really tied up in that. Well, I don't understand why you want that. I don't understand why you need this apology. I don't understand what, well, do you really need to understand that? Or do you just need to hear that that's what's important and that that's what's needed and then act accordingly?
Mm-hmm.
But I like, yeah, that the things that you would never see or look at or hear, I don't think you ever really will look at those things by yourself. You need somebody to help you.
Yeah. Hmm. And then in terms of like the qualities of good storytelling, what I'm kind of picking up from your journey is, as you said, like listening so key. And that has really been a theme throughout this show since I started, just people talking so much about the value of listening. And then we're also been talking about this term of explorer or to explore.
Yeah.
And to me, what that word is really all about, and I think is again another theme in your work, is all about curiosity and openness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great challenge for, it sounds like, both of us, and I would say it to the listeners too, is we have this natural tendency to, when we're home or in the place that we're comfortable, to shut off that curiosity. Because everything is so normal. And I think that's what it is for me, is when I'm traveling or going to different places, like suddenly I'm just curious about everything because I do not know anything. And I think that when you approach life with that sense of curiosity, the world has a lot more color. And I think it's a great reminder for me to bring that curiosity to my day-to-day, to my normalcy, as a way to let that really open up for me.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, there's something about curiosity. I mean, I guess the other thing, though, as storytellers, right, is that, and this is probably the thing I struggle with in the field the most, is having all the experiences and the conversations and the photographs and all the things, that's only the first part. And that's probably why I'm committed to staying home and writing at the moment. Like, our job is to share that. And that takes time.
Yep.
And that's where you got to put your head down and in some ways, would I say turn your curiosity off? I don't know. That sounds like a terrible thing to say. But because sometimes you just got to get the job done.
For sure.
And maybe that's what I use home for, but mm-hmm. maybe too much, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I'm home. I just got to like do this and this and I got a list and I got to just keep going. And yeah, so I suppose that's another question of balance.
Yeah, yeah.
But that curiosity is, it's fun.
Totally. I love it. all right, we're almost out of time. So yeah. Let's see. If people are interested in following you and your work, where should we send them?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can find out all about my work at jenniferkingsley.ca, which is my website.
Okay.
On Instagram, it's at Meet the North.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, those are probably the best two places. I mean, I am on Twitter. We have a Facebook page. But yeah, looking up my name is probably the best thing.
Jennifer Kingsley. Check it out, everybody.
Yeah.
if people out there listening are interested for themselves in meeting the North, where's one place where you suggest, you should go here?
To go to the Arctic.
Yeah, but where specifically?
Oh, right. Well, first thing is like, I would love to have more people take my advice that I'm not following, which is like this idea of actually talking to people and listening to stories and finding out what's important to them wherever you live.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's certainly a challenge that I should take up. This conversation has got me thinking more about that. In terms of going to the North, it's a really good question because, like I said, it's so diverse. And of course, I haven't been everywhere in the North. Yeah, I think the parts of the, I mean, Iceland is certainly an Arctic country and is definitely the most accessible.
Okay.
Western Greenland is absolutely beautiful. Probably feels a bit more Arctic-y, depending on what you think when you think about the Arctic, and is still relatively accessible with flights from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you guys in the U.S., you've got a great big Arctic. It's not so hard to get up there.
Yep.
With all of your Alaska Airlines flights.
Yeah.
I
really want to go there.
And then the places up north that you have to work harder for, you know, the Canadian Arctic, certainly the Russian Arctic.
Mm.
But yeah, so those ones, unless you go by ship, going by ship to the Arctic is a really good option because it's just a very good way to get around. And typically a lot of these places don't have a lot of infrastructure or it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, going on a ship is a really good way if you want to kind of get your feet wet.
Cool.
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah. and the last question that we'll end on. So the people who listen to this podcast, they're people who are telling stories in all sorts of mediums. So that's anywhere from artists to musicians to journalists to photographers. And I'm wondering, based on your journey as a storyteller, what you've learned from Meet the North, not only that, but writing your book and everything that you've been through. What are some things that you'd really want to leave us with as we're all kind of trying, we're all on this journey of trying to become better storytellers ourselves. What are some of the things that you'd want to leave people with today?
Oh, good question. You got to start doing like blog posts or Instagram posts where you post all the advice we give each other. I want to hear all of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The first thing is I think we need to do our work. So like, yes, you network, you apply for grants, you have sponsorships, you do all that stuff. You meet people, you try to meet the right people, you pitch. But we have to do our work. Like in the end, that's what we'll have at the end of our lives to look back on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what will build our path more than anything else. And it's so easy to find yourself like, oh my goodness, I haven't actually done any of the work in a while. Mm. Because there's so much that surrounds it. There's so much that surrounds it if you're an independent producer, right?
Oh, okay.
And it's just so easy to be like, oh no, but I got to promote it. I got to get on social. I got to go to this event. I got to meet people. But like, if you're a filmmaker, you got to make films. If you're a writer, you got to write. You got to read.
Gotcha.
We have to just do the work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That sounds so simple, but I don't know. And then I think the other thing is like stick together. I mean, it's an industry where there's a lot of hierarchy. There's a lot of kind of verticality. Like you try to get from here up, up, up. But there's more and more power, I think, in these like peer-to-peer connections.
Mm-hmm.
And just the power of like reaching out
instead
of up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and like do stuff like you're doing. Like reach out to other storytellers. I mean, just think this is great that you're like, I want to learn more and I want to meet people and I want to have these conversations and...
Yeah, it kind of feels just, like
it's cool.
It kind of feels like a cheat code, like because I can just message anyone like yourself or I'm sending messages on Instagram to like Tom Hanks or anyone. And I have like an excuse to reach out. It's so great.
Yeah, but it's smart. Like,
well, thank you.
And you're doing the work. I mean, podcast takes work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love that. Do the work.
That's the thing. Like, that's one thing you asked me about audio. Like audio is not just putting a microphone in front of someone.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a movie is not just pressing record.
Right.
You know, you have to find your story and carve it out. But I mean, I do have times when I get discouraged. And for me, that's when I go back to books and just remember that those are the stories that raised me.
Yeah.
And that if I ever wonder, like, what's the point? I just think about all the books that I've read that have really touched me or changed me or taught me something. Mm. It was like the purpose of this and like the power of this or its potential is undeniable, at least to me.
It's a great place to end. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank everyone for listening to the show. We will see you next week. That is it for episode 15 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much for listening. For me, that conversation gave me a lot of things to think about, especially being someone who does a lot of international storytelling. And it had me reflecting on what it means to tell stories of a place that's foreign to me. And I thought Jennifer had so much wisdom around how to do that in a respectful and responsible way. So thank you, Jennifer, for joining me today. Please go say hello to Jennifer Kingsley on social media. Again, she is at Meet the North on Instagram, or her website is jenniferkingsley.ca. Let her know what resonated with you. Our theme music today is from the always amazing Opus Orange. And if you enjoyed the episode, please consider sharing it with a friend and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. And if you're interested in being even more a part of this show, with the chance to have your questions answered by guests like Jennifer, check out my new Patreon page at www.patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. Patreon is a membership platform where you can pledge as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And in return, you'll get sweet perks on the back end, like asking questions to podcast guests and becoming a part of a private community of storytellers on Facebook. So check that out, patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. We're just getting it going. Sweet. And with that, I think that's it. I will see you next week. Go out and tell some stories.